This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Robert Siegel. The power of a biopic is immense. Scholars may write volumes about T.E. Lawrence, but a deluge of contrary facts could never dampen the image that millions have of Peter O'Toole portraying him in Lawrence of Arabia. Put a historical figure in a movie and make the movie a hit, and Russell Crowe becomes everyone's idea of John Nash with the beautiful mind. The real-life Woodward and Bernstein must bunk in the same neurons where Robert Redford and Dustin Hoffman reside. So, with some new biographical films in the theaters this season, we thought we'd devote some time this week to a little truth-squatting. Not just did that happen in 1959 or was it 1961, but does that film give a truthful sense of that person or of that event? Today's movie, My Week with Marilyn.
I started this heat wave by letting my seed wave, and in such a way that the customers say that can.
That is not Marilyn Monroe. It's Michelle Williams playing her. My Week with Marilyn is about Monroe making The Prince and the Showgirl with Laurence Olivier, who also directed that movie. Joining us from London is Sarah Churchwell, professor of literature at the University of East Anglia and author of The Many Lives of Marilyn Monroe. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
And first, in general, you've read just about everything there is to read about Marilyn Monroe and written about all that. Does this movie ring true to you?
Well, in one way, yes, and in one way, no. I suppose that's a very typical academic answer. Where it's truthful is I do think that Michelle Williams's performance is really quite extraordinary. And as you could hear even in the clip that you played there, she gets the voice unbelievably well. And she also gets Monroe's trademark mannerisms, but she resists the temptation to fall into the stereotype of the breathy whisper. She lets her speak like a human being, and yet it sounds and looks like Marilyn. So that part I think they do really well. Overall, however, the problem is what they've chosen to do is to film a story that is only very broadly based in fact. And a lot of its claims, I think most people who know about Marilyn's life and work are pretty skeptical of the claims of the author of this book to have had some kind of a fling with her.
Yeah, this is Colin Clark, who is working, I gather, as third assistant director on Olivier's movie. He's the son of Kenneth Clark of Civilization fame. Public television viewers may recall that from years ago. He wrote about his relationship with Monroe during the making of this film, and his memoir doesn't ring true to you?
Well, you know, one is tempted to use words like alleged a fair amount when one's talking about this book. I mean, look, the basic facts of it are perfectly true. He was the third assistant director on The Prince and the Showgirl, which was made in 1956. He certainly met Marilyn and worked with her. I think that there are certain very little moments in he actually wrote two books, one in 1995 and one in 2000. And this film is an amalgam of the two books. And certain little claims that he makes, I think, absolutely ring true. For example, he says that there's a little joke that Marilyn made at his expense, teasing him, where she says, "Oh, Colin, and you an old Etonian," making a little joke about his having gone to Eton. And that really rings true because he said that he was surprised that she knew where he'd gone to school and what it meant. So I think little throwaway moments like that, there are little bits where you think, yeah, that probably happened. But the larger claim that he had this week where Arthur Miller had gone back to America and he had this week with Marilyn and that they basically had some kind of little quasi-affair, although he has the good taste not to claim that he actually slept with her, which is a relief for anybody who's read a lot of the Kiss and Tell memoirs about Marilyn. But he does claim that he was there on the night that she had a miscarriage. He does claim that she told him all kinds of intimate details, which coincidentally appear in virtually every biography of her. So there's nothing in these books specifically about Marilyn that he couldn't have found out. And more importantly, he waited some 40 years after the fact to publish them, which does make one think, you know, having read all of these biographies, that he capitalized on her fame and her familiarity and wrote a couple of books claiming a little bit more than happened.
Colin Clark, who wrote these memoirs, died in 2002, so we really can't have him come on to defend his memoirs at this point.
Well, true enough, but he also did the same thing to everybody in his books because he waited until they were all dead and couldn't comment.
Now, the story that Colin Clark, the memoirist here, was watching unfold was the making of a film in which, as the movie tells it, Laurence Olivier, the director and co-star, is terribly frustrated by dealing with Monroe, who has her coach from the Actors Studio in New York with her. And I want to play you a little bit. This is Michelle Williams as Monroe and Eddie Redmayne playing Colin Clark.
Why is Sir Olivier so mean? He talks awful to me. Like he's slumming.
I'll tell you what's wrong. It's agony for him because he is a great actor that wants to be a film star. And it's agony for you because you're a film star who wants to be a great actress. And this film won't help either of you.
It's the kind of epigram that remains with you, whether it's true or not. It's a wonderful line. Is this movie a great moment in the career of either Monroe or Olivier?
Well, again, I'm afraid I'm going to hedge and say yes and no. Look, the movie is not a particularly good movie. I don't know anybody who finishes The Prince and the Showgirl and says, wow, that's a classic, or what a wonderful comedy. And certainly, I think most people agree that the best films that Marilyn was in were certainly Some Like It Hot, and some would argue for Gentlemen Prefer Blondes. But she does, in my opinion, give one of her best performances in it, which is very ironic because Olivier was indeed frustrated by her. I would say that if anything, this film is understated in its presentation of their conflict, and it makes them both really rather more polite to each other than by all accounts they actually were. So it's ironic that out of all of this unhappiness, she actually produced a really funny and sensitive and charming little comedic role. Unfortunately, it's very funny because Olivier, of course, is a great actor, and I'd be the last person to dispute that. And you go to this film thinking, well, he's going to act her off the screen. But he's very wooden. He's very hammy. And I realized after watching this film a couple of times that for all Olivier's greatness, one thing nobody ever said about his performances was that he was very funny. And he's actually not a very good comedian, I don't think. And she is a very fine comedian. And that's what comes through in the film.
He is played in the movie by Kenneth Branagh. And yes, she can't get straight what he should be called. She keeps calling him Sir Olivier or whatever phrase.
Yeah, I think that's a little bit of a cheap joke, to be honest. She wasn't that ignorant, you know. I mean, she was insecure about her lack of formal education, and she called him Sir Olivier as a joke. She certainly wasn't, you know, quite the bimbo that makes her sound.
It's one of the best-looking Arthur Millers I've seen in a movie, in a fictional movie.
Yeah, I think Arthur Miller could be flattered by that. And I do think that Branagh does a great job as Olivier. I think it's a very funny and very kind of bravura star turn. And as far as the sort of impersonations that go on throughout the film, I think, you know, a lot of them as performances do a very good job.
Well, Sarah Churchwell, thanks a lot for talking with us.
Thank you.
Sarah Churchwell is Professor of American Literature and American Studies at the University of East Anglia in England. She is the author of The Many Lives of Marilyn Monroe, and she spoke to us from London.
We're having a heat wave, a tropical heat wave. The way that I move, that thermometer proves.
She certainly, certainly, certainly can.
This is All Things Considered.
Good morning, I'm Linda Wertheimer. A rare and early motorcycle is up for auction next month. It has both pedals and a motor, but no brakes or clutch. The 1906 Indian Camelback hasn't been ridden in 40 years, and it's covered in rust. But guess what? It's also an original owned by the family which manufactured Indian cycles. This rusty wreck is likely to fetch up to $75,000. It's Morning Edition.
When Oprah Winfrey ended her show on broadcast TV earlier this year, there were many tears and endless tributes to the Queen of Daytime Talk. She left to focus on OWN, O-W-N, the Oprah Winfrey Network. The first of the year marks the cable channel's first anniversary, but the ratings so far have been a major disappointment. So now Oprah herself is about to debut a new show, NPR's Elizabeth Blair reports.
OWN is a joint venture between Oprah Winfrey's Harpo Productions and Discovery. It's a 24-hour mixed bag.
We're going to make Mongolian beef.
Maybe for the first time, the pain of these wounded warriors.
We've been trying to open a third Sweetie Pie location for 2 years.
And for that reason, I am going to help you rebuild your school. I'm donating $1.5 million.
OWN took over the space that belonged to Discovery Health, a channel that struggled to find an audience. And most everyone thought Oprah's network would easily outdo it.
And that simply hasn't happened.
Larry Gerbrandt is an analyst with Media Valuation Partners.
With the Oprah brand name, with all the work they did leading into the launch of the network, the hope and expectation was that they would be on a much faster track than usual.
It was a rough first year. OWN's ratings quickly nosedived after its launch. In May, the CEO was shown the door. Oprah herself said it might have been better to wait until after ending her daytime broadcast show before launching the channel. In July, she named herself CEO. But even a new show with Rosie O'Donnell hasn't pumped up the ratings.
I know what you're thinking. Rosie, you're wearing a poncho again.
It's hardly scientific, but I went to a place that attracts Oprah's core audience, women, and where the TV is on all the time. Patsy's Nail Bar in Washington, D.C., where Oprah's daytime talk show has been replaced by Ellen DeGeneres. As her nails are being done, Diane Montas says OWN lacks consistency.
Yeah, I watched a couple of things, not as often because it's now it's like all over the place, and it's not as focused as her own show.
Oprah Winfrey has been candid about the problems. She did a live web chat with Facebook CEO Sheryl Sandberg. She admitted that running a network is nothing like doing your own show.
It's very different choosing other shows and trying to feel, will this work, will that not work? So it's, I would say, a lot harder than I ever imagined. If anybody asks you if you want a network, think about that.
So what's the problem? Larry Gerbrandt says cable is such a different animal than broadcast. So for starters, people can't find OWN, and they don't yet have a signature show.
Something that you can say, ah, yes, I know that one is on OWN. And without that, you have nothing to build around.
Now, it's fair to say that anything Oprah Winfrey does gets extra scrutiny. She is, after all, one of the most influential women in the world. But even for her, it may take years before this cable channel is a success, says Eric Logan, president of OWN.
This is a very long journey, and I think if you look at any successful cable network, it's taken years for them to find their programming rhythm. It's taken years for them to establish themselves. You know, and Oprah's the first to say, you know, we're still learning.
And as for that signature show that OWN needs, it could be the one that debuts this weekend, starring the CEO herself. It's called Oprah's Next Chapter. Elizabeth Blair, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
For many people, 2012 will begin with popping a bottle of champagne or sparkling wine. It's the go-to drink for the celebratory moments in our lives. And it turns out, champagne is far more versatile than you may think. Beyond just pouring it into a glass, you can mix it with any number of spirits to create a range of champagne cocktails. And for a few ideas, we're joined by respected mixologist Greg Sider. He co-owns the Summit Bar in New York's East Village. New York Magazine once named it the city's best cocktail bar, and Greg Sider is at our New York Bureau. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Jack. Very great to be here.
Happy New Year to you.
Happy New Year to you.
You know, the champagne cocktail is one of my favorite celebratory drinks. How do you make yours?
We have a bunch of different versions. One that starts off like a little simpler, French 75, would be a simple gin, lemon juice, slight bit of agave, topped with Prosecco or champagne would be like a nice starter.
And what's the classic champagne cocktail? I just thought champagne, a little bitters, a sugar cube.
That would be your original.
Let's get to your New Year's Eve recommendations. You gave us one that you call a GP Spritz. Tell us about it.
Yeah, the GP Spritz actually inspired from my friend Andy Mosier down in Atlanta. So what I do is I take hibiscus flowers and I infuse that in agave. And we add Aperol, a little bit of lemon juice, and then actually a hibiscus tincture, which is basically a concentrated bitter. And shake that up and then actually serve that on the rocks. And we top that with like 3.5 ounces of Prosecco.
Well, I'm reeling already. Where do you get hibiscus flowers in the middle of the winter, though, if you don't live in Atlanta?
You can just get the tea. And you would just do a concentrated, maybe you do 8 tea bags to, if you didn't have agave, you could do half sugar, half water. And you do like 8 bags of tea to a quart, and then you have a nice syrup that you can use as a go-to.
Okay. So keep some of that hibiscus infusion on hand.
Yeah, it's like an emergency, along with batteries and the flashlights.
So you also mentioned using Aperol in this spritz, and that's an orange liqueur.
Yeah, the reason Aperol I find more versatile is because it has a rhubarb orange base to it, but it doesn't quite have the bitter finish of a Campari.
Mm-hmm.
So I found it's more accessible for a lot of people.
Give us a warm drink, would you please?
Well, I like to do like kind of a twist on the hot toddy. It's always like nice and simple where you could use Irish whiskey. I like bourbon or rum as a nice twist, and just add some honey, a little bit of ginger, a squeeze of lemon, and hot water.
I love the way you just play with flavor.
Yeah, it's from like my culinary. I do a lot of cooking, and my friends are some of the best chefs in the city, so I get all my ideas from cooking, actually. I don't really get much inspiration from actual bar.
Greg Sider owns the Summit Bar and Prima in New York City, and he spoke to us from our New York Bureau. What a way to start the year. Thanks.
Cheers.
Go to our website, npr.org, for the recipe for GP Spritz. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. Scott Simon comes back next week. A happy new year. I'm Jackie Leiden.